In 1967, with his own navy of Scientologists, the Sea Organization, Ron Hubbard set sail. Hannah Elchingham, then 24, went with him. She'd never crewed on a large ship before, but Hubbard detected that she was unusually well-equipped for naval command.
Hubbard called me into his cabin and stood right in the doorway of his cabin, fiddling with the E-meter, and started asking me questions about when I had last been a captain. Well, this could only be past lives, because I've never been a captain in this life. So I started, you know, thinking back and came up with this past experience about being a space captain of a spaceship and being blown up in space and the planet was being invaded and all this fighting and blasting going on and so forth. And at the end of it, he peered over the E-meter at me and he said, "Were you one of the loyal officers?" And at that point, I got this uprush and I felt, good, I must have been one of those loyal officers. I must have been one of the elite.
The young Hannah was appointed captain of Hubbard's number 2 ship, a 400-ton trawler. His flagship was a 3,000-ton converted cattle ferry. On board, Hubbard had a personal guard called the Commodore's Messengers.
They took care of everything for him. They dressed him. They got him ready for bed. They lit his cigarettes. They held his ashtray.
Most of the messengers are young girls, 13, 14, 15. They were an extension of his communication. So when somebody saw them on the ship or they came up to them, it was like you were talking to him.
On one occasion, Jerry Armstrong, who'd been sent on a shore errand, was visited by one of Hubbard's messengers.
This was Terry, who was later to be my wife, and she came to me where I was working, and she said, "The Commodore wants to know, is it true that you went to the U.S. Embassy and applied for 30-some-odd visas?" And I said, "Yes, sir," because that's how you respond to the messenger. And her next message was, "The Commodore says you're a fucking asshole."
The attacks on Scientology had pitched Hubbard into one of his periodic depressions. His response was to take it out on his followers on sea and land. He designed a new disciplinary code called ethics, which put many of them into what he called lower conditions of existence, like liability, doubt, or treason. To rise out of these conditions, penances were required. Liability, for example, required you to deliver an effective blow to Scientology's enemies.
Everybody was supposedly in these lower conditions, which is quite astonishing, because everybody really loved Ron and wanted to contribute to having whatever his dreams might be come true.
What happened was it became a very heavy, almost military organization. People changed. I think people became scared. They were scared of ethics, scared of what would happen, and so they became, I think, very intimidated.
At sea, the cruelty extended to children. On one occasion, Hubbard was infuriated by a small boy who had unwittingly chewed a telex.
He put this 4.5-year-old little boy, Derek Green, into the chain locker for two days and two nights. It's a closed metal a container. It's wet, it's full of water and seaweed, it smells bad. But Derek was sitting up on the chain in this place on his own in the dark for 2 days and 2 nights. He was not allowed to go to the party. I mean, he had to go in the chain locker on his own, soil himself. He was given food. And I never went near it, the chain locker, while he was in there, but people heard him crying. That is sheer total brutality. That's child abuse.
People were in awe of him and people were frightened of him. He was the boss. He was the dictator. He could order anyone to do anything on board. He was ruthless. He could be at times charming, but he could also be very belligerent. and he could also be very uncaring and cruel.
Yet Hubbard's disciples continued to believe in him. In 1968, he took a select few around the Mediterranean on his yacht, the Enchanter, on a project he called the Mission into Time. The task was to find treasure Hubbard had buried during his previous lives.
We were in a tizzy, you know, all this excitement at this upcoming, very important mission. And I was amongst one of the chosen, and we sailed off with our metal detectors and went to a variety of locations and did find some metal at the basement of what he claimed used to be a temple in which he had liaisons with some priestess during his trips to Sardinia. There was metal buried down below, and he was very triumphant during those times. It was very heady stuff for us people. It had a very magical, magnetic, hypnotizing effect on the followers.
Hubbard was also engaged on a further great expansion of Scientology. Once a Scientologist reached the state of clear, he became an operating thetan, or OT. Hubbard now designed a series of secret OT levels. Each one was part of an unfolding saga, which revealed that we are all infested by thetans, the souls of exiles from the Galactic Federation, which under Prince Xenu ruled this sector of the galaxy 95 million years ago. If you ever reached the top OT level, you would have crossed the bridge to total freedom. As always in Scientology, each OT level could only be reached after an expensive course. Did Hubbard believe it, or was he having his followers on?
He probably always knew he was running a con. You know, he must have known that much of the stuff he was talking about was sort of rubbish. But I think after a while, when he found there were thousands of people and the adulation around the planet for this man, I think that started to take him over. I think he began to believe that he was, if not God, then very close to God.
Hubbard's new cosmology was accompanied by new forms of punishment on board ship. Crew members who displeased him were liable to be thrown overboard before being retrieved from the harbor below. If they reoffended, they were tied up and blindfolded first.
I saw one woman, Julia Lewis Salmon, from the United States, thrown overboard. This woman must have been in her 50s. She had her hands and I think her feet tied, maybe only her hands tied and a blindfold. But she went over. She was so panicked at the thought of being thrown over this way. She was standing on the edge of the deck, panicked, beside herself, shouting. And I was standing on the A deck with Hubbard and his other aides watching this going on. And Julia didn't jump over. She had to be pushed over because she was incapable. She was in such a fit.
He saw everyone suspiciously and assumed everyone was intentionally attacking him. Governments were attacking him. And then everyone around who made a mistake, they also were attacking him. And the only thing he could do would be to attack back.
In 1973, a French court started proceedings against Hubbard for fraud. He had left his ship, which was berthed in Morocco, and went to live in hiding in New York, where he was looked after by Jim DinCalsi. To turn the tables on his enemies, he devised a bizarre plan called Snow White. Its stated aim was to correct false reports about Scientology. It led to Scientology members infiltrating government departments. Hubbard even issued a reading list for learning the black arts of espionage.
He believed that there was an international cabal that was in control of the attack on him around the world, as well as the attacks on various countries. And so Snow White was written to find this cabal, find all the connections between all these enemy groups, to expose them, to destroy them. It was done through infiltration. In some cases, it was done through burglary. It was just pure military intelligence.
Having instigated Snow White, Hubbard rejoined his ship in the Canary Islands. There, he had a serious motorbike accident. His mood dramatically worsened.
This was his period, which I call the pouting, the crying, the mad period, where he would cry and throw things against the wall, the bulkheads, and pout and scream. But right toward the tail end of that, he created the RPF, the Rehabilitation Project Force.
The RPF was yet another correctional regime. Its orders were fearsome. As ship's captain, it was Hannah Eltringham's job to implement them.
I was absolutely horrified when I read them, because they talked about the creation of this pretty much like a slave labor camp. Those weren't the words used, but that was the impression given, where the unwanted, those found wanting, seriously wanting, were sent, and they were to be kept in this with no rights, no freedoms, no privileges of any kind. Pretty much the basic rights they were allowed were a little bit of sleep each day, food leftovers, the harshest treatment. They were not allowed to speak to any of the crew. It was very, very, very bad that this was going on. But Hubbard's statement to us was that it's going to take a lot more ethics and a lot more punishment than anyone can easily face up to get this whole world back in shape. And at that point, I believed that statement.
Human emotion and reaction is the way humans were. And he didn't specially regard humans very highly. He liked the idea of the doll bodies that were in other civilizations. Doll bodies didn't have human emotions and reactions. They were, I guess, like Spock, you know, just very analytical. You just get the job done, no emotions there. Love is not a sentiment that's known or cared for. So, and that's, to me, the tragedy, because he put that, I feel, into the organization and into the way of being in the organization.
Hubbard even consigned his own son, Quentin, who was a senior auditor on the ship, to the RPF.
Quentin really was a real sweet kid. He was a real nice guy and very soft-spoken. And it was very difficult for him being Hubbard's son and being put on in this very high position, and I don't think he was that interested in it. He just wanted to be a pilot, and also the fact that he was gay, and that's a very tough thing in Scientology, to be gay, because especially that kid, to be Hubbard's son and to be this top technical person and be gay, oh, that would be a horrible thing to be wrestling with and suppressing all the time.
Quentin was sent to the RPF after he committed the sin of trying to commit suicide. 2 years later, he succeeded.
Hubbard saw it as a betrayal because everything was referenced around him. The world was doing everything to him. This technology that was supposed to work didn't even work on the senior person of all technology. You know, Hubbard and his son, you know, no, he just saw that as an attack from his son. And that's, you know, the love was gone. He had lost love.
In 1975, Hubbard decided it was time to come ashore. He sent scouts to look for a suitable land base. They settled on Clearwater, in the rich state of Florida.
He stated coming ashore would be profitable because we could get so many more people to the Flag Land Base, as it was to be called, for auditing and training. And he also wanted to concentrate on getting professionals to the land base because, of course, they had more accessible money. They had pension funds, they had children's education funds, and some of these he named that were accessible.
Hubbard knew Scientology would be unwelcome, so he devised a top-secret battle plan. He called it Operation Goldmine. Using a cover name, the United Churches of Florida, Hubbard issued secret orders to take over the town.
These orders, in effect, very clearly stated, move into this area, find out who your friends are, develop them, find out who your enemies are, destroy them, and then move into every possible area of community life, business, social, religious, education.
The plan worked. Clearwater is a Scientology bastion. Scientology owns many prime sites. Big name Scientologists like Lisa Marie Presley have moved in.
You could get all the big high rollers, you get the people with the dollars, and you can make a fortune. And I believe the income for a week, this is like in 1970, 78, 79, was somewhere, it's at $500,000 a week. I mean, that's where the big bucks started to be made, when you could do that.
With the money rolling in, Hubbard moved to California, where he'd play his last great role. His ambition was to film sci-fi blockbusters based on his books, but he ended up making Scientology training films.
The movie mogul, Cecil B. DeMille. You know, it was like he was. He tried to be bigger than life, but he just wasn't. So he would make these extravagant sets. They were ludicrous. They were not big productions. They were just silliness. They were an egomaniac. He tried to be flustery and big and powerful, but if you look, just stepped and observed, you could see that he had fear about everything. And finally, the fear came down to dust particles, little teeny dust particles.
He had phobias about dust. He had phobias about smells. He had phobias about sounds. So he would hear sounds that weren't there. He would scream at the sound technician. And he would see things that weren't there. And he would scream at the people who were framing the shot. And he would smell smells that weren't there. And he'd have people rinse his clothing some 13 or 15 or however many times.
In 1977, while Hubbard was away making movies, the FBI caught up with the Snow White operation and raided Scientology headquarters in Los Angeles and Washington. Hubbard's wife, Mary Sue, and eight other Scientology executives were convicted and sentenced for conspiracy and stealing government documents. Hubbard disappeared, never to be seen publicly again. After living in a succession of hiding places, he ended up on this secluded ranch in the California hills. Secrecy has veiled his final years, but one man, Robert Vaughan Young, who was then a Scientology public relations officer, was later given a description of Hubbard by one of his guardians. This, and evidence from Hubbard's autopsy report, paint a sad picture.
He had grown a beard, he had grown his long hair. The nails were long, very much in the same problem as they found out with Howard Hughes, unkempt nails. There was a neighbor that walked in on him one day, and he'd become very frightened and suddenly scurried out of the barn. He was frightened to meet people. He was terrified of meeting any new people. He was disappearing down into this little strange world of his that he had created. And the irony of this is a man that was promulgating and telling the world that with my technology and ideas you can get bigger and bigger and bigger, and yet he was shrinking down until finally he was hiding.
On January the 24th, 1986, Ron Hubbard died. The Church of Scientology said he'd simply quit his body to continue his work elsewhere.
Him dying suddenly made him very mortal. And the last thing we could have is to have Hubbard be mortal. So a story had to be designed. And the story is that he went off to research the next level. And what's amazing is how the Scientologists bought this without any questioning. They bought it.
Today, the L. Ron Hubbard image is carefully protected by the Church of Scientology. It says he is the greatest humanitarian in history, Hollywood has named a street after him, and millions of dollars roll into Scientology every year. It continues to preach that Hubbard's teachings are the best solution to the mental problems of the world. The personal tragedy is, one mind Scientology did not appear to help was that of its founder.
Secret Lives next Wednesday at 9 profiles the holiday camp king, Billy Butlin. Our film next tonight on 4 is Caddyshack.